I just, there was no like cultural or intellectual life, you know, even the theater geek world and the band world, that was very minimal. And the people that were in it were not very creative, in my opinion. So I'm not trying to, again, I'm not trying to trash like all these people. They had talents and stuff. They just weren't realized. And there was no big movement to kind of push everyone forward. So it was everyone for themselves. And then towards the end of the 70s, you know, there was a palpable, in retrospect, not so much then and when I was there, but palpable swing to the right until Reagan gets into power. And that was a shock to a lot of people. I mean, I already hated Carter. I had no, in fact, I had another teacher yell at me and say I was an anarchist, which I kind of was. It was the 10th grade, socialization. I wrote an essay I was really proud of, and she gave it a really bad grade. And I said, you know, what's wrong with it? She goes, well, that's anarchism, Jeff. I said, I hope so. But I, you know, my anarchist phase was very short-lived, but it was there, you know.
So did you gave me an F because of your opinions on my anarchism?
I didn't get that an F, but wrong. I got like a C.
That or is wrong.
I
supposed to be.
The conversation ended very quickly after that. And then I was like, but I've talked about this on the show before, that growing up in the 70s, here's an illustrative thing, at least where I grew up, you could get your hands on anarchist stuff. It was actually in the school library. Much more easier than you could ever find. I don't remember any mention of socialism, really. Even in social studies, they must have mentioned it, but
so you didn't have, I don't really remember it. You know? Or no
one ever. If they Engels. Mentioned it, it was just like as an expletive or something bad. Commies. And then, you know, if you just hear it as a bad thing, it might get you interested, but it didn't for me. I think they were more clever than that in my school, the teachers. They just ignored mostly the left. And the anarchist stuff I discovered on my own. But the fact that I could get a something by Alexander Berkman or Emma Goldman in a school library, but I couldn't. I had no knowledge of Marx. I'm sure there was nothing by Marx there. That's always struck me later as really, really unfair. I mean, some of my first real introduction to socialism came from triggers like The Clash. You know, discovering The Clash in 1978, 79.
Now, in college, did you get to read more?
College in my first year in philosophy class, they gave us this Communist Manifesto. Boom. That just blew me away. That was the bomb, as they say. Yeah.
On your first day of what?
No, not first day, but really early in philosophy class.
Philosophy.
In college, freshman year, in a conservative college. Wow. Because I went to St. Bonaventure University for 2 years before I transferred to Boston University and graduated from Boston University.
And they gave you the manifesto.
They gave me the manifesto. Wow. And I went, I loved it, man. And the teacher was scared of my reaction. He had to pull back. I'm like, this makes a lot of sense, blah, blah. And I always talked a lot in those kind of classes. And
so what, he pulled back, man. The manifesto. You go like, no, I don't agree, you know, like, but
he'd
you agree,
it to
so
you.
Now he's scared.
He'd give it to you, yeah. And I think he liked it to a certain extent. I think he wanted you to know about it. But then he would come in with
read
all this
it
stuff.
With caution.
And also, the version I was given I found out that a lot of, whenever I encountered socialist ideas in college, it was almost always not the original texts. Now, this was the original text of the Communist Manifesto, but with an introduction by this infamous guy, A.J.P. Taylor, that in a lot of college textbooks of the time, he would write an anti-socialist scree, just nonsense, really, before you read the thing. So you're always reading something to debunk. It's the way my son's being taught now.
So you get this introduction that goes against it, but if you read it, now you're forming your own opinion.
Yeah.
You're
supposed to believe the introduction more than the real text.
Yeah.
And then later, you don't even get the real text. You just get people talking about it, you know, the real texts. And so my son, for example, is given the first he ever heard of socialism was in school, is Animal Farm by George Orwell. And his teacher never told him George Orwell was a socialist, you know?
I always thought Animal Farm was something similar to what was happening now in capitalism.
Well, it was meant more
was
as
capitalism.
A the way the right wing spins it, and I think Orwell did believe some of this, it was against Stalinism.
Okay.
And there's a big debate among people that analyze it from the left, whether he included Lenin in that criticism or not. Trotsky is a sympathetic figure, at least the animal that you think is Trotsky is a sympathetic figure for a while. But basically, it's a very pessimistic novel. It ends up, everyone's equal, but pigs are more equal, or whatever that famous line is from it. Ignores a lot of other Orwell's work, like Amish to Catalonia. And he went up and down. Orwell was my
favorite. 1984.
Yeah, Orwell was which they claim is totally about socialism, but Orwell himself said it was also about capitalism. So the thing with Orwell is that he had his periods where he was a socialist of some sort, and his periods where he was in retreat from that. And the common denominator is that he never, except for in Spain, he never was in an organization. He was in the PUM, the Trotskyist-inspired group.
Land and Freedom. Yeah. It's like Land and Freedom.
Land and Freedom, yeah. In fact, Land and Freedom is a film by Ken Loach based on Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell.
I got to get that at Amazon because nobody else has it. They had it in the library. And they lost. Somebody just kept it. And I'm like, damn it.
It's a great
damn
film.
Damn it, I should have taken it myself.
Loach is a brilliant director, and he's a Trotskyist of some of sorts. Mm-hmm. And
Irish.
In that no, he's British. Yeah.
I thought he was Irish.
No, he did the one with the IRA
or whatever.
He's done more than one. He did The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is excellent. And then very early in his career, he did a movie about the repression of the Irish movement in the 60s, in British. Not a documentary, although he comes from documentaries. It was a drama, and I forget the name of it, sorry. But, Land and Freedom is really worth watching. And he does something in Land and Freedom that is brilliant, where he takes political debate and makes it exciting. Like, there's this part in Land and Freedom.
They're in church.
Based on real stuff.
All debating.
Where they took over. They weren't in church. They were in a building. But they, or a house even, I think it was. But anyway, they took over.
Like a meeting hall.
Not sure it was a meeting hall. But anyway, they took over there was a debate scene in a meeting hall, but this is later in the film where they liberated a town from the fascists. And the peasants, leaders, and just peasants and workers all got crammed in this room, including the fighters. And each fighter had sort of a different political background. You could tell by what they were saying if you knew about the politics. This is something you couldn't learn from the film. You have to know a little bit of pre-knowledge. But you could tell each where they were coming from philosophically by what they said. And what they said, though, was agitational. It wasn't just like they weren't giving lectures. They were like, "Say we should do this." But you could tell the way they said it and what they advocated, who they were, where they were coming from. So they had an American in there who was a Stalinist, part of the Abraham Lincoln Brigades, that gave the Stalinist version of things, which is we should not collectivize the land we took over. We have to watch out for how the imperialists view us. In other words, that kind of Stalin, by the late 30s, the Stalinists, or by the 30s, the Stalinists were all about getting the best deal they can with imperialism, not so much about revolution, even though this guy was fighting on the side of revolution. And the Stalinists played a really bad role, actually, in Spain, ultimately, and in the Spanish Revolution. Then you have the anarchist say something that, boom, that's an anarchist. Then you have the PUM guy. Oh, that's different. That's the PUM. That's Trotskyism. It was really amazing. You should watch it again. Have you seen it at all?
I've seen it.
Yeah. So you know,
2011.
The scene
but like I said, about, in the library system, someone must have just said, oh, no, I'm keeping this.
Yeah.
So there goes the public for
they should buy a new one.
But what I'm going to do is I can get it on Amazon, and I've seen it. So.
Yeah, I get this discussion with someone at work who is really smart about computers and stuff, and sometimes he gives me copies of stuff to watch, and I started talking to him about like the proliferance of the streaming services like Amazon and so on. And I thought he would really be into it because he's such a computer geek, right? And what he said was that it kind of bothers me because they're moving away from the idea of people owning content. Meaning, like, if I buy a DVD, I own that copy of that content. And I have it with me, and I can put it in a DVD player whenever I want. If it's streaming, as you know, from Netflix, whatever, it can disappear tomorrow, and you'll never get it. You'll never see it.
Yeah.
So I was like, my son is going to study Romeo and Juliet, and I wanted him to watch Shakespeare in Love, that film that was made back in the 90s. And I only had it on VHS. I can't play VHS stuff anymore, and I'm really pissed about that, to be honest with you. So I had to go to Amazon, which I hate. I had my wife actually did this using a card
I had. Well, you can get a stream, or you can actually buy the physical.
What I'm saying is streaming's bad, because streaming is their control.
Yep.
Streaming is they can yank it from you at any time. You don't really own it.
Exactly.
Unless you download it somehow. And I don't know. I think that's too complicated. And they must have ways to stop that. But maybe not. Maybe it's easy to download. But anyway, my point is that unless you download something or you own it from buying it on DVD or whatever, then I think it's vulnerable It's precarious. You know, someday you could just disappear on you. Mm-hmm. And I'm really worried when they stop building DVD players, which is probably coming up soon, because then DVDs are going to go the way of VHS, and then pretty soon it's going to be all streaming. And unless you learn how to download that, which is going to be declared, which is considered illegal, quote unquote, then you're not going to own a physical copy of anything. And even then, what are you going to have to put physical copies on? People are downloading stuff onto discs, like, you know, CD-ROMs or whatever. How long before they get rid of those? Because they say, oh, you don't need it. It's all on the internet. But they don't understand the internet can be so easily controlled. There's countries like China that just shut down the internet, you know, or big chunks of it, you know.
Oh, in a way, regimes. In a way, I don't blame them because, you know, I feel we're in a society where everybody's just, their heads are down the little iPads or whatever.
Yeah, but that's different. That's a different problem.
There's no interaction no more.
Like, yeah, that's a different, I agree with that, but that's a different problem. What I'm talking about is like, you find something you like, Land and Freedom, and pretty soon you're not going to be able to get it. The library won't renew, won't buy the thing.
Yeah. It's not even available. They have certain copies.
Okay, let's look at it from another angle. Mm-hmm. Some of the companies that make product for Netflix and so on, they will also put the product out in DVD. Like you just showed me the Marx movie, right? What's it called again?
Young Karl Marx by
Young Peg. Karl Marx, right? We can get this in the library, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard, maybe it's not true, but I've heard that Amazon doesn't issue DVDs of the stuff they have streaming. So in other words, I can't go to the library and get copies of Man of the Far Castle, or whatever it's called.
Man of the Castle?
I'm screwing up the title.
The High Castle?
Man of the High Castle or something like that.
Yeah, it's been one thing. I read the book and I want to get it, but it's only on Amazon Prime and stream.
That's what I'm saying. Like, so now do you understand what I'm saying?
And I asked the library and they're like, no, that's Amazon. That's not us.
That's what I'm talking about. I don't want that situation to spread to everything.
That looks like a good movie.
And then one day the thing disappears. We don't consider that important. And people that study this stuff have written studies about how each time you go to a new format, the capitalists, each time they go to a new format and market that, you lose content. In other words, there are many films that never got put into VHS. There are many VHS plus films that never got put in DVD. There are many films on DVD, VHS, and back to the original film that never got to streaming. This is a huge, huge problem, you know, again, because the capitalists control the content, whereas if, you know, and that shouldn't exist, right? That's why we're socialists, right? We want to get to the point where the people control stuff like that democratically. But even under that, even under capitalism, at least if I have a copy of a DVD, and as long as they're making DVD players, I can throw that DVD in any time, exactly. Whether they've eliminated it or not, or they've disappeared it or not, mm-hmm. You know, that's all I'm getting at. Little digression there, but anyway, let's get into the with our remaining time. We're gonna go a little fast now. LA teacher strike was happening. I don't know if people followed it, our listeners followed it last week, but it was the lessons from the strike are many. But one of the main ones I really want our listeners to think about and is that when you read in the corporate media such and such a thing is illegal, they play with that. They choose to emphasize that or not depending on the situation. LA teacher strike, illegal. West Virginia teacher strike, illegal. Most public sector strikes are considered illegal. But many happen, especially when they happen in a mass way, like LA teachers were very well organized, tens of thousands in the streets. No one brings up, even the corporate media doesn't say, well, this is illegal, they should all be arrested. Because what would it look like to arrest 10,000 teachers, you know?
Because it's united.
United and big, exactly. It has a lot of popular support.
How many paddy wagons are you going to need for that amount of teachers?
And that's
and
an
teachers.
Important lesson.
That's another.
Because if you go to then some other state, like Oklahoma, where the teachers want to go on strike, they're being threatened with legal action. Even though they exist under the same law, virtually, essentially, as the other teachers that have already gone on strike. So the reason I'm raising that also is look at the recent propaganda around the government shutdown. When it got to the TSA workers, they had some TSA union guy who was an idiot on the media, in the corporate media, saying, well, you know, we're not supposed to be political and we can't really go on strike. It's illegal and all that. Wrong, wrong. You're political whether you know it or not.
Resign.
Exactly.
That's what I told him. Yeah. Resign.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
You're political whether you know it or not. And the...
your workers ain't getting
paid. Your illegality...
I wonder if he's getting paid.
You know, at a certain point, everything is illegal. Every progressive thing is illegal under capitalism. So when you had slavery, it was illegal to be, you know, to become a freed slave and to, you know, for abolitionists to help you become a freed slave and so on. All that stuff was illegal at a certain point. Then it was chipped away at, but it was still the heavy illegality around the slave trade. Strikes and unions were illegal at one time, completely, you know. There, you know, it always takes, you have to, the civil rights movement was all around breaking laws, you know. The big sit-down strikes, they call them, which are basically plant occupations, factory occupations, in the 1930s, broke every law in the books. Because the most sacrosanct law under capitalism is private property, meaning big private property of the big capitalists, like factories. They claim that's their private property, when, of course, it's a social thing, but they claim it's their private property. Every sit-down strike, so-called, which is really a plant occupation, better name for it, was completely illegal from start to finish. But they had the numbers, and they had the popular support. So the government was afraid, in many cases, to go in, and sometimes they tried, but they even lost, and sometimes just wouldn't even try, didn't even start to take, you know, try to take back the plant. Because, you know, the workers could destroy the machinery, and they were, and it would have been a bloodbath, and it looked really bad for the local administration, the public administration. So, but there's other times when they use repression. I'm not saying they never use repression. What I'm trying to say is that legality and illegality are fluid concepts. They have to be, they cannot be, we cannot bow down as working people, especially as union members and so on, you can, and being in political parties, you can't bow down to the concept of illegality, because so many things that should be perfectly legal and actually encouraged, like strikes, are considered often illegal. So I hope that made sense. But so the LA, one of the main lessons for the LA teacher strike is completely illegal, they still went on strike, and they won, depending. There's some people that think there wasn't a great victory. I've heard that, you know, the main reason they went out was for non-wage issues, although they did win a 6% wage increase over, not sure what the time frame is. This guy, I'm reading some of this from kind of irritating article. At first I was excited about it, then the more I read about it, the more irritated I was. Glenn Sachs for Counterpunch, LA Teachers Strike Dispatch number 9. I guess he's a teacher, and this is supposed to be what we won, but it's very confusing. So anyway, I try to dig out of it some things they won. There were some things he calls intangibles, and I agree with his general point here. Despite the usual PR hatchet job that the anti-union, anti-public school forces have waged for the past 25 years, the general public was, quote, still very much believes in public education and teachers, because their whole thing was, part of their thing was to stop charter school erosion, which is huge. There's a huge amount of charter schools in LA, and the rich people, both, and by the way, both Democrats and Republicans, parties are into this, are into the charter schools. He says even the media at one point turned more sympathetic. They weren't originally sympathetic, but because of the power of the strike, that changed a bit. There was a plan by the administration in Los Angeles, again run by Democrats, to go to break up the schools in Los Angeles into 32 separate entities and to charterize it, meaning basically privatize it. I mean, charter schools are private schools, but they're using public money, and they're a step towards outright privatization overall. And that has suffered a serious blow, he claims. By the way, the United Teachers of Los Angeles, if you go to their website, UTLA, you can find more information about how they are spinning this. But there are teachers not they could have done better, because, for example, one of the reasons they went out, very concrete reason, class sizes. Class sizes are way too big. So they got, in the next year, a reduction of one student per grade level, immediate reduction from secondary schools from 46 to 39 for English and math. 2020, 2021, additional one student per grade level. 2021-22. So incrementally they go down, but very incrementally. So by the end of 2022, you have like supposedly four less students in your classes, which could be as large as 39 for math and English if they go down to 39. The other thing is making sure all this happens, which is tricky. They got them to hire 150 full-time nurses, or at least 150 for 2021 also, and provide a full-time nurse at every school every day of the week. So if that happens, that sounds pretty good. Hire 41 full-time teacher librarians each year, 2019, and also 41 more, 2020 to 2021. So same thing with counselors. They got more counselors, which was down to 500 to 1 per school. It was like a horrible ratio. Imagine if you're a counselor and you got 500.
Are you serious? 500
yeah,
students?
Yeah, it was 500 to 1. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is going to make it 500 to 1, which, of course, is still way too much. So, so now you're getting a glimpse at why some people didn't like it. On testing, mandated testing, they didn't really win much. Yeah, so I don't know. It's a lot of stuff that the wage increase doesn't sound like that much because it's 6% over a certain number of years. Again, I forget the number of years. I don't know. It's just like I heard that there were members of the union that didn't like the settlement, although it did pass. I'm pretty sure it passed the vote. Let's see. And this guy doesn't even talk about the salary, which I think is a mistake. He mentions it and says they weren't on strike for salary, but that's not really, you know, you have to get a higher salary to survive. I'm sure the teachers are really suffering from low wages. They had some smaller gains that he mentions regarding everything from special education to how substitutes are treated to union rights. And so basically he says the bottom line, we fought for this agreement for 21 months, worked without a contract for 18 months, and finally forced the law struck for 7 days. Were you following that, by the way? Did you hear about the strike?
Yes.
Yeah. What we ended up with was vast. Where'd you hear about it? Just curious.
I heard that it took 2 weeks, but I remember.
No, well, this says 7 days, but where'd you hear about it, though?
That program that I go on, you know, and midnight or so.
I didn't see much in the corporate media at first, and I think they kind of later finally started talking
about it. I'm more of a radio guy. I like to listen a lot
yeah.
radio.
What we ended up with, he says, is a vastly better than what was originally offered and significantly better than what we were offered on the eve of the strike. There are certainly things lacking in the agreement, but it's a major step forward. So, you know, if I get more information about how people were reacting internally, I'll bring it on here. Often, of course, after a strike, people are anxious to settle, even if it's not that good. So really quick, I want to turn people on to an article, Time for the U.S. Yellow Vests. Now, this refers to the French.
What happened in France?
What is it? I forget the name in French. Gilets jaunes, I think it's called. Vests yellow or yellow vests. And so he riffs on this guy, Paul Street, who I really like because he's usually... He unfortunately caved a little bit, but he's usually against any support for Democrats. And so he says that, well, he goes, here are 7 things you won't hear much, if anything, about in the reigning corporate media regarding the ongoing record-setting partial shutdown of the U.S. government. And he uses that to riff on all sorts of stuff. Now, the thing that I wanted to focus on, I urge you to read the articles from Counterpunch, January 23rd, Paul Street. Some things that were interesting in here I thought were, okay, so you have these right-wingers like Bannon and Norquist. He quotes Grover Norquist and this guy Bannon. There's many others. And that the ones that want to drown the state, quote-unquote, you know, remember you heard that, right? Make the state small. But here's the reality, and we've talked about this on the show before.
Like Trump who wants to drain the swamp.
Drain the swamp. There you go, exactly. Beneath their anti-statist discourse about the great conflict between government bureaucracy bad and free market good, which is really a false, I will just add here, a false paradigm completely. You can't have the market without the strong, violent hand of the government, actually. They wish to aggressively wield state policy of a specifically regressive, plutocratic, and authoritarian sort. They don't really want to destroy the state. They want to defund and delegitimize what the late French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu called, quote, the left hand of the state, the programs and services won by past popular struggles and social movements for social justice, equality, environmental protection, and the common good. They do not wish to axe the right hand of the state, the parts that provide service and welfare to concentrated wealth and dole out punishment, including rampant mass incarceration and felony marking. I've never heard that term before, felony marking. That's a great term. For the poor, and right-handed social control functions tend to rise when left-handed ones fall. They do not go after America's Pentagon system. That's the thing about libertarians, right? You hear, no state, no state. Well, what about no army? Nah, they stop with that. We need the army, yeah. A great cost-plus subsidy for the high-tech corporations like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing. It's not about whether the state should work or exist. It's about who government should work for, the public and the working class majority, or leading centers of concentrated wealth and power. Then he talks about the bipartisan terror of neoliberalism. I love this part. How richly complicit the contemporary Democratic Party is in the ugly and regressive neoliberal project. The 2018-19 lockout may be primarily owned by Trump and the Republicans. As, for example, MSNBC will tell you again and again. The Democrats have participated in the assault on positive government functions across the whole long neoliberal era. This is another thing we've talked about on the show. The deregulation of corporations rose dramatically under the Jimmy Carter presidency. I rarely read that, even though it's an established fact. You know, everyone said, the lazy thinkers, even on the left, were like, oh, it began with Reagan. Then begin with Reagan. It began with Carter, the real clawback. I mean, if you really want to get into it, you would look even at the Nixon administration, which under pressure gave a lot of concessions, but also had some things that they went after, of course. Then there was the arch neoliberal president, Bill Clinton, who probably proclaimed that, quote, the era of big government is over, end quote. That's a Clinton quote. And then signed off on ending poor families' entitlement to federal cash assistance while advancing racist mass incarceration with his three strikes bill. Three strikes comes from the Clinton administration. Clinton passed the North American Free Trade Agreement, a new continental bill of regulation-free rights for global investment capital. He also went on to work with Republicans to deregulate derivatives and the financial sector more broadly. He instituted giant Cold War-level defense empire budgets, a massive taxpayer windfall for corporate war masters, remained the rule under Clinton, despite the collapse of the only other planetary superpower, the Soviet Union, right before the beginning of Clinton's presidency. Clinton was a masterful, silver-tongued, fake progressive champion of the U.S. bourgeois states movement from left to right, handed state power when it comes to enforcing social control on the victims of the nation's intertwined regimes of class rule and racial oppression. So, of course, was Obama, whose richly right-handed neoliberal imperial policy record have been detailed on numerous prior occasions. So then, listen to this one. A lot of people don't know about this. Wall Street Dems for the wall, right? Now there's a narrative Democrats are against the wall, Republicans are for the wall. Well, key Democrats like Obama, Clinton, and Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer have in the past supported border fencing. All three voted for the Secure Fence Act of 2006. All three supported the 2013 Senate immigration overhaul that passed the Senate, which called for tougher border security, including additional physical barrier construction. As Oliver Ortega noted on Counterpunch 2 years ago, the border wall was a bipartisan project before it became a partisan football under Trump. When President Trump signed executive order last week to complete the wall, a wall along 2,000-mile border with Mexico, he was building on decades of bipartisan consensus among lawmakers. In fact, Congress had already approved a border wall not too long ago. In 2006, legislators, including many Democrats, passed the Secure Fence Act, which called for 700 miles of double fence construction along certain stretches of the border. Trump cited the Bush-era law in the first paragraph of the executive order he signed Wednesday as rationale for his executive authority to order a wall be built. Many of the same Democratic leaders now bemoaning Trump's wall voted for one at the time. Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, Dianne Feinstein, then Senator Barack Obama, who as president would later deport a record high 3 million people during his two terms, lauded the bill on the Senate floor, saying it would, quote, help stem some of the tide of illegal immigration in this country. And let's not forget Bill Clinton's critical wall building activities in anticipation of heightened Mexican in-migration expected result from NAFTA's decimation of Mexican farmers, as Ortega noted, quote, the most pivotal moments in the militarization of the border arguably took place during the time of Obama's Democratic predecessor, Bill Clinton. Operation Gatekeeper, quote unquote, passed in 1994, poured billions of dollars into border security. High-intensity stadium lights, motion detectors, remote video surveillance were installed along key points of the U.S.-Mexico divide, and the amount of Border Patrol agents was increased by roughly a third. With resources deployed to patrol densely populated sectors, undocumented immigrants were often forced to trek barren desert and mountains. Thousands died in their quest for a better life. Quote, we will not surrender our borders to those who wish to exploit our history of compassion and justice, President Clinton said at the time. It's no coincidence that Operation Gatekeeper followed another landmark in U.S.-Mexico relations that year, the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. Big agriculture flooded the Mexican market with heavily subsidized corn and other staples, displacing small farmers in Mexico in one of the greatest neoliberal coups in history. The result was a flood of immigrants heading northbound in search of opportunities, accelerating one of the largest mass movements largest mass movements of people in history. In short, the U.S. government acting in the service of corporate profits caused the very mass migration it spent the last 25 years trying to keep out and criminalize. There's other good things in the article. The reason I went into such detail there is because, as we've talked about on the show before, there's very little historical memory in the United States. And I'm not talking about just the intentional ignoring of historical facts that, you know, the corporate media does, or that right-wing professors will do, or whatever, or even liberal professors.
Or not mention.
Yeah,
there's no mention, there's no memory at all.
Yeah. Even among working
as
people.
It's never happened.
Even among progressives, real lack of memory because there's no big workers' party in this country. And there has never been. The Socialist Party started to achieve that status around the turn of the 20th century. But for a long time, no mass workers' party, just the bourgeois capitalist parties of the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, the pro-corporate and imperialist parties, Democrats, Republicans, over and over and over. In other countries, the only reason that there's, like, more left media in many countries, independent of the corporations, the only reason there's more sort of knowledge about class and class consciousness, and that fluctuates from time to time, is being cut across in many European countries where there used to be strong class consciousness, now there's anti-immigrant stuff going on, and the right is gaining. But even so, in many countries, even with the right gaining ground, you can find a stronger left than here with a better historical memory. And the average person knows more about the history of the country and the history of the working class and so on. Main reason for that is material. If you don't have a political party, a mass political party with resources that can set up alternative media or help people that do that, or, you know, give a voice to people that do that as part of their program or whatever. If you don't have, like, for example, when the left was gaining power, ground, never gained total power, but was gaining ground in the 60s and 70s, like we were talking about, you saw enormous funding for the arts that you never saw before, for films and stuff. So Ken Loach comes from that, for example. He started out working for the British government making documentaries, right? Years later, even in Europe, funding for films, for art in general, from the state, higher than the United States, but still cut, you know, on the defensive, you know? So that's in the realm of art, but in the realm of, like, just, you know, journalism, alternative history going out through popular media of some sort. Like in France, I don't know what it's like now, but back before like everything was, you know, on computers, you went to a newsstand, you could get like 3 or 4 papers at least from a left-wing perspective that were not funded by big corporations or the government.
Newsstands.
Or the government, yeah. And then you'd find other things that, like, in other countries, they were talking about Scandinavia, so I don't know if this still exists, but in Sweden, the unions got powerful enough that they would, they would fund think tanks, they would fund international solidarity to other, in other countries, help union movements in other countries and stuff like that. So there was material gain, not just in terms of social benefits and good stuff like that, but in terms of also the left having everything from meeting places to alternative media. And the longer that the so-called left-wingers in the United States promote the Democratic Party in whatever way they do it, whether they realize they're doing it or not, they're putting off the building of that very important workers' party, independent party, which will in turn strengthen their movement in ways they don't even realize, in ways that will free up money and resources and create an audience for actually, you know, truly independent left-wing socialist and whatever media and so on. So I read something like this Paul Street article on Counterpunch, just a taste of what you could have on a regular basis if we had a workers' party. So check out that article. I got to give do a quick public service announcement. We do this every show, and we have to do that. And I almost left it out. But let's see real quickly.
Do you got the numbers to think about, or
I don't know. I got old ones here, definitely. Most DJs, I think, use the online one, but I'm going to use the old paper one here, which I don't know how much it gets.
Cover your computer.
Yeah, there's a good one. Why not cover your computer camera? This is an ongoing public service announcement here from WMFO. If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover that camera up with a piece of opaque tape? Opaque means you can't see through it, like black tape.
I do it at the library and I get stares like, why is he putting opaque on that?
In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WMFO and Medford Tufts Educational Radio. That's another name for us, Tufts Educational Radio. And did you know, speeding right along, it's 100 years after the murder of Rosa Luxemburg.
Yep.
Yeah, 1918, right?
Jeez.
Or 1919, I'm not sure which. So, this is an article
and
from...
And her husband.
Was that her husband? Was that her partner? Was Liebknecht her partner? I don't know that.
Yeah, I think they both were murdered.
I don't know if they were married, though. But anyway, Carl Liebknecht was also murdered. Yes, they were both murdered. So this is from the Socialist Party of Ireland, I believe, website, January 24th, 2019. It might have also come from socialistworld.net. And it's called 100 Years After Her Murder, Remembering Rosa Luxemburg. And I like it because it's a very brief article, clearly meant for people that haven't heard much about Luxembourg. So if you have already read about Rosa Luxemburg, great. Keep on reading. But this is going to be a basic introduction. So Rosa Luxemburg was a leader of the German working class and revolutionary movement. Together with her comrade Karl Liebknecht, she was murdered 100 years ago in Berlin following their betrayal by the German Social Democratic leadership. Now, the Social Democratic Party was called the SPD, and it was a party that started off as a socialist party, started off with revolutionary traditions, but became more conservative over time.
Was that headed by Kautsky?
Yeah, they basically at this time...
And that's where Lenin and him split.
Exactly, over support for World War One, and the real socialists did not support World War One, and that means with actions. They didn't support it with actions, they didn't support it with words.
Or credits or whatever.
Yeah, the SPD supported World War One through voting for funding for the war, and probably propagandistically as well, but I don't know enough about that to say for sure. But they did, they were so into their, own version, the Social Democratic, German Social Democratic Party, the SPD leadership, in terms of making their unholy peace with the government around that time, because there was a lot of pressure on them, they killed Luxemburg and Liebknecht, assassinated them. Her contribution to the socialist movement was, Rosa Luxemburg, her contribution was vast and far-reaching as a writer, speaker, and organizer dedicated to building a working-class movement to overthrow capitalism. She wrote extensively on many aspects of Marxist theory, including economics, and she also lectured over many years at schools organized by the Social Democratic Party. That's kind of what I was getting into. If you build a workers' party, you can have schools, you can have all this other stuff. It doesn't mean then you're immune to the problems that they ended up having of reformism, but for a while at least it would be a very progressive thing. Alongside her refusal to abandon internationalism with the outbreak of World War One, her exploration of the limitations of reformism, forms part of her political legacy. Her pamphlet, Reform or Revolution, written in 1900, remains very important today. Luxemburg was, she wasn't right on every question on revolutionary organization, as well as how socialists approach the national question. Luxembourg's positions continue correctly to be criticized. For example, Lenin criticized them. But at the same time, Lenin and others saw that overall she was a great leader and a really good theoretician in many cases. And it gets into her biography a little bit, and I'll just jump to the end. When Luxemburg was murdered, the German... A working class was robbed of one of its finest, most capable leaders. One of the tragic results was the failure of the revolutionary movement in Germany, which led to the strengthening of the right-wing forces and later Hitler's ascent to power. Her legacy remains a guide to action for socialists internationally. Working to achieve the creation of a socialist world is the best tribute we can make to Rosa Luxemburg today. So I just thought I'd give anyone that might not have heard about Rosa Luxemburg a little nudge to go read more about her. And find out more about the time around her, which was an exciting time for socialism. She's a hero to socialism. Her and Liebknecht are heroes to the socialist movement internationally. Why don't we talk about that book before we run out of time?
Okay. Chris Hedges, he wrote a book, I think, this year.
Diego brought a book in here. You were talking about it last time.
I was going to do a book review. And I saw this on RT today, which I was excited on Christmas when I found out that the cable all of a sudden has this on my package. You know, like, wow. I didn't.
What, Chris Hedges?
No, RT Today.
Oh,
Russia
I see.
Today,
yeah.
America.
Okay. Yep.
And it's the title is America, the Farewell Tour.
When did it come out?
Chris
this year?
Hedges. Last year, I think. Let me check. Yeah, last year, 2018. Okay. So, let me just give you the the summary here of what's this book about. Is America in a state of irrecoverable decline? In this provocative and disturbing examination of our country, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges argues that the United States shows unmistakable signs of a dying culture. Across the country, Americans are suffering from chronic unemployment, declining wages, and a morbid despair that expresses itself through compulsive gambling, sadistic pornography, and a deadly opioid epidemic. Xenophobia, I think that's
Xenophobia.
I'm sorry.
That's right.
My first language is Spanish, so bear with me. Has become rampant as a desperate and bitter underclass searches for scapegoats. America's social fabric is unraveling, while at the same time we face global upheaval caused in the part by catastrophic climate change. All these ills presage a frightening reconfiguration of a nation and the planet. Donald Trump rolled this disenchantment to power. In America, the Farewell Tour, Hedges argues that neither political party, now captured by corporate power, will address our systematic problem. Until our corporate coup d'etat is reversed, our problems will grow and ravage the country. A poignant cry reported from communities across the country, from Atlantic City to San Francisco. America, the Farewell Tour seeks to jolt us out of our complacency while there is still time to take action. And I'm just going to quote this one passage that he said in RT Today.
Yep.
Sorry.
Have you read his stuff before?
I have.
Yep, good.
So, he just... This is what got me interested in the book when they asked about this quote and he read it. And so he writes, "This moment in history marks the end of a long, sad tale of greed and murder by the white races. It is inevitable that for the final show, we vomited up a figure like Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent 5 centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, and polluting the earth in the name of human progress. They used their technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machines on the planet, directed against anyone and anything, especially indigenous cultures, which stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believe that this orgy of blood and gold would never end, and they still do believe it. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalist and imperialist expansion is dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited."
Yep.
End quote.
Yeah, I used to read his stuff. He endorsed Shama Sawant, for example, the member of Social Alternative that was elected to city council now twice, but he endorsed the original and probably the second run and spoke with her on a panel. And I used to read his stuff in...
they actually met?
Yeah. I used to read his stuff. I forget where. It wasn't Truth Out.
He's Counterpunch, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was more in Counterpunch. He used to be in Counterpunch. Now I think everything
wasn't
he writes.
Wasn't he the originator?
No. That was Patrick. Sorry. That was somebody else's name.
So he did a lot of Coburn. Stuff for Counterpunch.
He did. Now he's mostly writing, I think, for it's either called Truth Dig or Truth Out. Do you know which
Truth
one it is?
Dig. Truth
Can
Dig.
Can I see the thing? Maybe they say it. Let me just see what it is.
Yeah.
Let's see. Chris Hedges, blah, blah. True, they're not going to mention it. Bummer. Okay. It writes a weekly column. Oh, yeah, dude. Website Truth Dig. Hosts the Emmy-nominated show on Contact on RT America. That's what you watch, right?
Yes.
Do you ever see him on Contact?
That was the interview.
Oh, in here.
That was the show on Contact in RT Today.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, and for people that aren't aware of him, he started off as a mainstream journalist for New York Times
crimes,
and so on.
The New York crimes.
Writing and writing about the wars in the Middle East and so on. And then he became anti-war, I think, during the Iraq War, and I think he had already left the Times. I'm not sure about that, but I remember he gave a speech at a college and he got booed. It was like a conservative student body there for the most part.
The first Iraq or the second Iraq War?
I don't remember. That's a problem. I think it was the second one. But and then he started to get more well known through combining anti-war writing with also just in some ways, anti-capitalist, but ultimately he is not a socialist, unfortunately, but he seems to go towards that and then pull back, you know, like a lot of intellectuals do, especially in America. But he writes some good stuff. And by the way, I should have mentioned earlier in the show, and we're going to definitely go into this next time. So Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, second name Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. She's a member of Socialist Alternative who was elected as an open socialist and member of Socialist Alternative back in, 2014, I think, to city council, maybe it was a little earlier than that, in Seattle. And this was the first open socialist in a long time elected to any city council. And we're not talking about DSA-type socialists, someone that supports the Democratic Party and all that stuff. This is, you know, Shama did not... And Social Alternative at the time did not support the Democratic Party, and she got elected. And it was and she won against a 16-year incumbent who had started off as a Green Party candidate way, way back, and then went over to the Democrats for many, many years, and was just complacent in his position and so on. And Shama came in with the help of Socialist Alternative and others, and boom. And part of the main campaign thing program was a $15 minimum wage, which was won soon after Shama got in. So, you know, I think Social Alternative has created a new use that Americans aren't used to of if you're elected, it's not, you don't just then disappear into the legislative back rooms, but you vote symbolically, and it will be picked up in the wrong way. Like, say you vote against something good on the surface, the corporate media usually won't go into the details. They'll say, oh, this person voted against it because it was watered down by the Democrats to the point where it took too long to come into implementation or something. They won't say that. They'll say, oh, the person voted against 15. That, you know, how, you know, and then you're known as someone against 15. So unfortunately, especially if you're not part of a larger party in power or vying for power, then it's hard. It's very, very hard. And now Amazon's pissed off, of course, even more than they were before. The big corporations hate, of course, Shama being the only socialist. In fact, that she got reelected with a much larger vote margin the second time she ran. They hate the fact that she's an open socialist and Social Alternative is so active in the city and so on. So this time around, there's a reelection happening, and Shama has declared she's going to run again, along, you know, obviously as part of Social Alternative, as a member of Social Alternative, and getting help from others and so on. And that just happened this week, that formal announcement. There were two of them, and they're really good. I need to get copies of them. We'll talk about it next time. So we're going to be talking more and more about the Shama Sawant re-election campaign, because even though we've like tried to build socialist alliances out there, they haven't really caught on. And there's the whole thing of the Democrats, DSA people calling themselves socialists and all that, that it gets really confusing. And waters down the clear, you know, independent socialist elections that have happened. And anyway, we're fighting again for re-election under even tougher conditions. That's the main point. And we'll get more into that next time.
But we're winning. We won again and again. And
twice, and won a lot of stuff. But there's no guarantee of, especially since there's no Workers'
Party
built. But
that shows that there's people
interim.
That actually are conscious.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's favorable.
Definitely. So as we said, we're going to kind of check out a little early today, unfortunately, because there's a meeting coming up. What's the song on the Lauryn Hill thing you want me to do?
Final Hour, number 7.
Thank you. And so we're going to go out with a Lauryn Hill song. You're promising me it's political, right?
It is.
No, they don't have to be refugee. Explicitly political. Yeah, that's
fine. I mean, she's a Fuji.
And so we want to thank everyone for listening. You can go check out the show on archive for the next 2 weeks at WMFO.org. You can check us out on Facebook at Socialist Alternative Radio. And check out socialistalternative.org's website, socialistworld.net, the website of the CWI, for more, thinking along the lines of what we've been talking about. Diego, I'm glad you could make it this week. Any last words?
Thank you. Like always, power to the people. Life. Yeah. And the workers.
Yeah. How's the job going, by the way?
Huh?
How's the job going? Still good?
It's going.
Yeah.
It's all right. I mean, it's better than where I've been last year, I'll tell you that. I mean, economically, but...
Yeah.
But I can also see, you know.
I just got a, I helped organize.
I see the bad and the good.
Yeah, you know me too.
I take it for a grain of salt, you know what I mean?
Me too. I just I helped organize the union where I work originally when it came in, and now we're getting raises like 1.5, 2%. It's just gross. It's just disgusting. We need a lot more than that. Everything's going up. You know, they say it's not, but it is. Everything's more expensive. They had a thing on National Propaganda Radio today about college. No, I'm sorry, it was on a conservative radio station, more conservative even than them, radio station, if you can believe it. That one, WBZ, you know, that big one, AM one that has that huge signal. So they had this investment guy on. He's going yapping about college. And actually, he was kind of accurate. He was like, people are putting more money into these funds than ever before to save for college. There was like an actual tax fund, like you don't pay tax on or something like that. He says... But, and even this guy said this, he goes, but the amount that people are saving on average, which is about $25,000, is not nearly what you need for college. You know, that could be, college is now like $50,000 a year and stuff. I mean, he was saying contradictory things. He was saying, well, there's more deals out there now in some schools with tuition breaks and free tuition at some public schools and all that. But then he contradicts himself and says, but wait a minute, everyone's saving money, you're not saving enough money. But you can't save any money. You got to spend the money to survive. Right, you know,
it works for a system that is contradictory.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, well, that's it for Social Alternative Radio. Check us out next time in a couple weeks, and don't believe the hype.
The hype. I gotta bring that in. I think I have that.
Whether
album.
It's liberal
don't
hype,
don't believe the hype by Public Enemy.
Yeah, okay. whether it's liberal hype or conservative hype, it's pro-capitalist hype and it's wrong. So thanks again. We're gonna go out with Lauryn Hill.
Up this beat like I'm Deuce. Two people both equal like I'm Gemini. I'd rather send me on. If I Jimmy on this lock, I can pop it. You can't stop it, drop it. Your whole crew microscopic like particles while I make international articles and on the cover. Don't discuss the baby mother business. I've been in this dirt up and you can't tell me I witnessed first handed. I'm candid, you can't stand it. Respect demanded and get flown around the planet. Rock hard like granite or steel, people feel. Lauryn Hill from Newark to Israel, and this is real. So I keep making the street ballads while you looking for dressing to go with your tough salad. You get the money, get the power. Keep your eyes on, keep your eyes on. Yo, you can get the money, you can get the power. Keep your eyes on, the final hour. Change the focus from the richest to the brokest. I wrote this opus to reverse the hypnosis. Whoever closest to the line gon' win it. You gon' fall trying to ball while my team win the pennant. I'm about to be in it for a minute, then run for Senate. Make a slumlord be the tenant. Give his money to kids to spend it. And then a minute, every law that ever prevented our survival. Since our rival documented in the Bible like Moses and Aaron. Things gon' change, it's apparent and all transparent. Gon' be seen through. Let God redeem you. Keep your dean true. You can get the green too. Watch out who you cling to. Observe how the queen doing. I remain calm, reading the 73rd Psalm. Cause with all this going on, I got the world in my palm. Now you can get the money, you can get the power. Keep your eyes on the final hour. You can get the money, you can get the power. Keep your eyes on the final hour. Now I'll be breaking bread, sipping Manischewitz wine. Ain't no mind, party like it's 1999. But when it come down, the ground beef like Palestine. Say your rhyme, let's see if they get you out your mind. Now I'ma get the mozzarella like a Rockefeller. Still be in the church of Lalabella, singing hymns a cappella, whether posed the Marabella in couture or collecting residuals from off the score. I'm making sure I'm with the 144. I been here before, this ain't a battle, this is war. Word to Boonie, I make a lot like a Sunni. Your diplomatic community in every ghetto community had opportunity. Went from hood shock to hood sheep, but it ain't what you cop, it's about what you keep. And even if they're leaks, you can't capsize the ship, cause I baptize my lips every time I take sips. You can get the money, you can get the power, keep your eyes on the final hour. Now you can get the money, you get the money, get the power, keep your eyes on the final hour. You can get the money, you can get the power, keep your eyes on the final hour. You can get the money, you can get the power, keep your eyes on the final hour. Money, you can get the money, you can get the money, get the money, get the money, you can get the money, you can get the money, you can get the money, the final hour.
Boston cream.